You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
If that didn't wake you up, I don't know what will. Good morning and welcome to this December 12th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. If we haven't mentioned this before, subscribe. We are on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. Your free subscription will get you the latest alerts on when shows are podcast. And who doesn't need a helpful reminder about that? I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about process, about craft. Another great morning when we have the luxury of time with only one author for the full hour. I love those mornings. Karen Bender is with me. She is the author of the story collection Refund, published by Counterpoint Press in 2015. It was a finalist for the National Book Award in Fiction. It was also on the shortlist for the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Prize and longlisted for the Story Prize. It was a Los Angeles Times bestseller, and she was on the show with me exactly almost 3 years ago to the day. I can't believe it. For that book. So you can find that podcast up on our website. Karen is the author of the novels Like Normal People, which was a Los Angeles Times bestseller, a Washington Post Best Book of the Year, and a Barnes & Noble Discover New Great Writers selection, and A Town of Empty Rooms. Her short fiction has appeared all over the place, but most notably in The New Yorker, in Granta, Plowshare, Zoetrope Story. Her stories have appeared in the Best American Short Stories, Best American Mystery Stories, New Stories from the South. She's gotten 2 Pushcart Prizes. Her story, Eternal Love, which, oh my God, I just love that story. Both that story and the 4th Prussian Dynasty have been read in the Selected Shorts program on NPR. And her story, The Cell Phones, which is in this collection, have been read by LeVar Burton on LeVar Burton Reads. Karen is the co-editor of the nonfiction anthology Choice, True Stories of Birth, Contraception, Infertility, Adoption, Single Parenthood, and Abortion. She's the fiction editor of the online literary magazine Scoundrel Time. She's taught all over the place, but she's currently teaching at Hollins University. Her new collection, The New Order, was published by Counterpoint Press last month. It will drive some of our discussion this morning. Karen, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be talking to you again.
Well, the honor is all mine.
Yay.
So we met on here a short 3 years ago, almost to the day, and it feels like several lifetimes to me. I don't know if it feels that way to you. And you've been very productive in these intervening years, way more so than I am. So I want to talk about productivity in these times, but congratulations on another wonderful, wonderful collection. That's great.
Oh, thank you.
So because I love these mornings when we have the luxury of time. So I thought, cause we didn't get a chance to talk about this last time, sort of your writing story. And you wrote this wonderful essay about getting hit in the head by a rock when you were a kid, and how that event sort of gave birth to your career. So I just kind of wanted to start with that and kind of, your origin story.
It feels now so long. it's interesting because I feel there are many stories to a writer's origin story. I feel that writers can kind of change and transform so many times over a career. So the story about the rock is a funny story where, I was 6 and I was at a birthday party, in California, in Los Angeles, where I grew up. And, the birthday boy is being chased by all the kids and they want to put him through the spanking machine, which is a thing where kids stood in kind of a row and he would crawl through their legs and people would spank him. And he did not want to go through the spanking machine. So he was running and he picked up this rock and threw it. And it sailed over all the other kids. I was just kind of standing around. And it hit me in the head right above the eye. And I fell back. I remember an adult picking me up and lifting me and bringing me to the birthday cake table and moving the birthday cake so it wouldn't get bloody and putting me down. All these little 6-year-olds surrounded me. you know, and were looking at me, and I just thought, oh, my God, this is not how the birthday was supposed to go. And what I remember is the idea the birthday cake had to be moved so it wouldn't get bloody. And I feel in a way that was one of my first writerly thoughts, because it was a way of imposing order on chaos, which I think all writing that I do or I want to do, I feel like is trying to do, because it's a way of trying to control the uncontrollable. Mm. And after that experience, and I did actually start writing stories, I kind of had to sit around with a bandage for a while. And so I started writing then, and then I wrote in elementary school, and you know, it was one thing I just liked to do, and I would read and you know, just want to respond to books that I loved. And then I went to college. I went first I went to Berkeley, and I actually wrote an essay about about my experience in a poetry class with Tom Gunn, which I was really excited to be in this poetry class. You know, I wrote this essay, "A Few of These Traits, You Might Be a Writer," which was just up on Lit Hub recently. And it's kind of about how I walked to his office, and I was so thrilled to be on the list in his class. And then I was in the class, and I had no idea really what anyone was talking about. I was not a very good poet. But I really wanted to write, and so I went to him and said, you know, do I have it in me to become a writer? And he said, well, you have plenty of talent, but you have to do a lot of work, which was actually a really generous response considering what I took into the class. But then, you know, it's something I think about now when students come, you know, to me and think, well, what are the traits that make one a writer? And I think hard work is a huge, and resilience and just stubbornness is just a huge part of it.
Yeah.
So I got really stubborn, and then I was at UCLA, and I took writing classes there from Carolyn Fee, who was really encouraging and nice. And then I went to New York. I moved to New York, and I took classes there. I had a really great teacher named Kaylee Jones, who I'm still in touch with, and she was encouraging. And then I went to Iowa, which was wonderful. I mean, it was really hard. It was Frank Conroy was the head person there, and he was incredibly tough. And I was kind of intimidated by him, but I felt like being around all these really, you know, really great writers, and you know, the rigor of that was terrific. And I met there, you know, some of my first readers, or you know, I tell students that, you know, the best one of the best things you can get from an MFA program is your readers. So one of my dearest friends, Jenny Litt, is one of my readers, and she read my first novel for me, and then my husband, Robert Anthony Siegel, who's also a writer, is also one of my readers. So we kind of formed this group, and we're reading each other's novels, you know, for like years after the program, which I think was really important to have a community.
Yeah.
You know, to have like a, you know, people that you can share work with, because it's so hard, especially writing the first book, I think is really brutal, especially in our culture where, you know, people just want to know if you've published, or you know, everything is very oriented toward, you know, are you making money through this work? And often the answer is no, you know. So to have a community is really helpful. And then I published my first first novel, Like Normal People, and then after that, I was working on stories, you know, and I think it's when I started working on stories, there was actually, I think things are really kind of a little bit different now, but I think there was just such an emphasis on novels, and everyone wanted me to be writing novels, so I wrote these stories, and then I had sent them to my agent, and he said, well, it'd be easier to have a novel to sell it with. So I wrote A Town of Empty Rooms. So this was kind of with, you know, our kids who were little. So it was kind of slow going. And then, you know, the novel, you know, sold after a while, and then Refund came out, and it was just to actually have the stories out was so thrilling, because I felt like in some ways, I mean, I love both forms, but I felt like writing stories was really, it just felt easier somehow for me. Like my mind kind of wrapped itself around the concept of a story in a way that felt easier. Mm-hmm. So then there's so I did Refund, and then after that, you know, that did so well. I just thought, well, what's next? And I did actually start a new novel, which I'm thinking about now. But I think what happened is then the world was just going so mad, you know, from 2014, 2015 on, I started responding to what was going on with the stories that are in the New Yorker. Yeah. I just, you know, because in a way you think about how to deal with the chaos, how do you control the chaos. It's either inside, you know, often, you know, I'll write from something internal that I'm trying to figure out or understand, or on the outside. And I feel like there was so much on the outside I wanted to converse with in the New Yorker. That's how I was doing with those stories. So right. It's kind of an abbreviated origin story.
No, that's that's great.
Yeah.
Before we dive into the New Order, on that continuum, sort of when did you settle into the idea that I am a writer? You know, that this is in my DNA, this is who I am. Was it but way back at that birthday party? Mm. Or, like, when did you get the sort of, I hate saying this to women, because I feel like it's a, but when did you have, like, men just feel like they have the authority sort of built into them, and I feel like women... sometimes women writers sometimes have to claim that authority. And I was wondering kind of when that came about and how, you know?
That's a great question. I mean, I think I did start writing, you know, when I was, you know, six, and I just kept writing. It was just something that I kept getting approval for. And I was fortunate in that my parents were super supportive. And, you know, my mother's a dancer choreographer and my father's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. And they were just very, very supportive of self-expression, and I feel incredibly lucky for that. So I did write, and you know, I actually, you know, I think I just did it. But I think one thing that was really helpful was my fifth grade teacher, Miss Ross, who had just all these wonderful creative assignments, and we were writing. All the time in her class, and it was just really part of the curriculum. And I remember one thing. This was in the 70s, and we had something called an open structure classroom, which meant that you could create your own schedule. It was almost like college. So I would schedule like my math unit and my reading unit early in the day, and then I would be done with all my little special classes, and I would just write most of the week.
Wow.
And I just look at that now, and I thought, what on earth? Like, how did LAUSD allow this? But it was fantastic. It was fantastic because I really got to sort of delve into it, and I think that's maybe a year I really felt like a writer. You know, and then I did keep doing it, and I know actually in junior high I kind of didn't do it. I was really interested. I was really into ballet and actually cello, and you know, which actually the New Order is refers back to.
Uh-huh,
and I kind of avoided it. And then when I was in college, I knew I wanted to do it, but I think I did have to kind of claim it then because I didn't, you know, I was actually a psychology major. There weren't creative writing majors, you know, then. And, you know, I took creative writing classes on the side, but I didn't realize that it was, you know, something one could do. I just kind of kept doing it.
Right.
But I always felt like one for a long time.
So great. That's so great to hear.
Yeah. I mean, partly I mean, it was one thing that I was, you know, I think people are also drawn to things that sometimes, like Flannery O'Connor says, I write because I'm good at it. And I think there's something that's actually very honest about that. I think it was one thing I was good at. You know, I was terrible at math. I wasn't, you know, other things were hard for me, but writing was always easy. It wasn't easy, but it was something that I felt I liked to do and I could do.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of writers are waiting for that external teacher or some or other writer to say to them, you have it, you have the gift. Go forth.
Right.
And they don't always get that. You know, it is just a ton of, as you say, it's a ton of time at task and it's a ton of discipline and all those things. But I feel like a lot of those new writers really want to hear, you know, go be a veterinarian instead. You know?
Oh, it's so hard. Well, I think the culture is really conspires to make it very hard to be a writer. not only financially. I mean, a lot of other countries have, you know, have fellowships and, you know, and fundraisers much more than we do. But I think it's just, you know, everyone wants you to be, you know, in a career that's identifiable. And I think people, I think, are also suspicious of creative pursuits. You know, there's something subversive about them. And being honest is not really valued in our culture emotionally, in addition now to factually, you know.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, that there's that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to dive into the new order and this idea of order from creating order from chaos. When we talked about Refund last time, we talked about it as a sort of a State of the Union collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really reflecting back the world we were living in, and the new order is certainly doing that. So I'll first let you sort of set the stage and kind of take us into this collection, and then we can kind of dig deeper into this idea of order from chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I worked on the new order, I think, you know, I don't tend to sit down and think, I want to write about this. I tend to kind of just let my subconscious and my feelings, my interests guide me, and then think about, is this a collection? When I actually sent, when I sent the book originally, it was actually some stories and a novella that was kind of bad. And so I had sent my editor, Dan Smetanka, and he saw a book in what was there, but I actually hadn't seen it the same way when I sent it. And I think, you know, I just wanted to wrestle with what, you know, just things that were going on. I mean, some of the first stories were on a scale of 1 to 10 and Mrs. America. And Mrs. America was trying to deal with the idea. It was written before the campaign. It started like 2014, and it was trying to explore like a Republican female candidate that I felt kind of started, you know, the whole lying as a form of campaigning, you know, in a way that was more extreme than I think probably in, you know, earlier campaigns. So I just wanted to try and understand, and also try and understand a character that was that could compartmentalize their lie from their kind of humanity. You know, like, how do people do that? You know.
Right.
So it was kind of looking at characters like that, and then when looking at chaos, I mean, then so you know, then I like the elevator was definitely in response to the Access Hollywood tapes. After that, I just thought, gosh, you know, I want to write a story that's kind of exploring what it would be to be one of the person, you know, one of the people that he talks about grabbing, essentially, you know, like how do you write about that experience so it's, you know, It connects with people, and they all were respond. You know, then they started responding to outside events in ways.
Mrs. America the first story you worked on in this collection? Was that the oldest story?
I think on a scale of 1 to 10 is the oldest.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is, and then the cell phones. Actually, an earlier version of that was maybe the first one. It was written before, it was probably 2014.
Which is funny because I don't want to give too much away about the collection, but the cell phone really ties all of the other stories up together. So it almost felt like it was written as almost an epilogue, you know, where it kind of makes mention of all of the other stories in some way. So that's...
Right. And that actually editorial change was made at the end.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
It was a very nice epilogue sort of story. Very cool. My guest this morning is Karen Bender. The book we are talking about is The New Order. It's her collection, 11 wonderful new short stories. So I was having lunch with a friend yesterday, and we were talking about this kind of concept of women's second shift, you know, that women have to have a career, they care for family, all that stuff. And then they kind of have to just make magic happen, or they have to kind of grease the emotional wounds of everyone around them. And after we had that conversation, I started looking at this collection through that lens. and it was so resonant and so
really, oh wow,
interesting. The unspoken burden on women to kind of manage the psychological needs of others and manage the emotions of others, and and all of these wonderful relationships that you have between women and kind of women's not only just their relationships, but how they undermine each other and how they, you know,
right.
that all of that complication. And I don't know if your intention to explore not only what's going on in the chaotic world around us, but this kind of other work of women was so interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I'm glad you got that from them. That's great to hear.
I don't know what the question is, but it's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. That's a great insight. I think, I'm just fascinated by writing about women. It just feels like there's so many stories that still need to be told on so many levels and are so interesting. We were watching the Elena Ferrante miniseries last night, and, you know, just thinking on her books and how they are just so great in their honesty and depiction of women's realities that feel really radical and new.
Yeah.
And she's just kind of expressing what is reality, you know, in many ways. So yeah, I think in terms of, the friendships and how friendships are complicated and, you know, relationships, you know, between women can be really interesting and rich. So I did want to write about that.
Yeah. The one where it really came up for me was the three interviews. I think that's the title of the three interviews. The expectation on women to not only, you know, work for you and apply for jobs, but to also fix all of these sort of existential wounds that you might have.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that was in the story, but that's true.
So funny.
Yeah.
I guess that brings up the question and our discussion about, making order from chaos, the kind of role of art versus the role of therapy. And I feel like writers do write to kind of control the world around them, but then you have to make that leap from, okay, I'm getting all of this out of my head, you know, in sort of a therapeutic way to make sense for myself, but I also have to make art. And I was wondering if you had any insights kind of on that line between therapy and art and, you know, when you've successfully made the transition from one to the other. Does that make sense?
It's a great, absolutely. And therapy is a big interest and, you know, of mine too. And, you know, my family is full of psychiatrists and therapists and writers. So, therapy is about telling stories and making connections and actually unburdening yourself often by telling stories. And I feel fiction is similar, except art is, it's different from life. It's highlighted in a way that's different. But it does need to be, it needs to feel true if it isn't necessarily true.
Yeah.
So the stories that you tell are not necessarily literally true, but they need to feel emotionally true. And I tell, you know, I have kind of a three-tier three pillars to becoming a writer is honesty, craft, and patience. You know, you start with honesty the things you feel need to be said that haven't been said and that you can say as a writer you've observed. And then craft, which is putting them through the funnel of plot and sensory detail and, you know, creating a container for the feelings. And then patience, which is revision, which is the really key thing to make it better. I taught a short story seminar this fall at Holland's, where we looked at a lot of short stories. And there is a great comment by Poe on plot and unity, where he talks about, he says, the greatest involution of infinite will not result in plot, which properly defined is that which no part can be displaced without ruin to the whole. You know, that there's the idea of unity, you know, that you want unity or totality of effect. And I think life is not necessarily a unified structure. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's a kind of a really messy narrative. And then to make something into a story, you need to think, how do you create, I call it a container, you know, but like a structure that will hold the feeling and the action in a way that feels more resonant than life. You know, it feels like you're entering it as a reader and you're participating.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So this might be a good time to do this. What I like to do lately, especially with short story writers, is to take a couple of stories from the collection. I can choose them or you can choose them. But maybe a story that gave you either the most difficulty in the revision process, or a story that was somehow elusive to you, or a story that may have changed the most from inception. And what I like to do is kind of dissect it. And we take it from that original kernel of your original idea and kind of what sparked it through to, you know, we do a little, you do a little MFA program on the air here.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. But do you want to pick one? I mean, I'm trying to think. I might have an idea, but which one were you thinking of?
Well, I mean, I do love the three interviews. I love them all. I love Mrs. America, too, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, we probably have time to do two of them. So I don't know if those two make sense or if there's another one that jumps out at you that's.
Yeah, I mean, those actually, in terms of difficult, those were not as hard. I mean, weirdly, the one that was the hardest was the first one, Where to Hide in the Sky.
Well, let's do that one. I love that one too.
So that one, so the original spark for that story was, it was actually a few years ago where I was listening to my daughter in the carpool, talk with a friend about a shooting. I think it was after the Aurora shooting in Colorado. And so, they were talking about, what would be the best thing to do if there's a shooting in a movie theater? And they're like, should we hide? Should we run out? You know, what's the best strategy? And I remember listening and just feeling, you know, we're just driving to school. And it just seemed so terrible that they were thinking about this. And just, you know, but also that that this was America now, right? That kids are thinking about this. Everyone is, right? So I started a story, Where to Hide in a Movie Theater, as kind of a short. Then there was Charlottesville. And Charlottesville, there was a story I read that was really haunting to me, in which there's a synagogue there during the march, and the people had to leave through the back door because there were guys who were armed surrounding the synagogue. And I just thought, this is insane, and I thought of setting it in the synagogue. So then I started just writing these sections, you know, that were directions. And it was about 10 pages. And I actually said to my husband Robert, and he said, you know, maybe there should be two characters. The narrator and her friend. And then at the end of that, I thought, oh, there needs to be a conflict beyond the outside situation. And that's why I thought the friend actually voted for Trump, you know, and that's something that did happen. You know, the Jewish community, you know, 70% voted for Hillary, but 30% voted for Trump. So, yeah, I think that's the percentage, something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's something that was kind of something that I felt I wanted to explore a little bit too. So, but you know, a friendship between two people. So then I started, you know, I sent it in, and my editor Dan said this should be longer. It should have them walking through the synagogue in the narrative, and then go into their lives, which was really great. Editorial input. So I started writing it, and it was hard, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what would they say to each other, and kind of revealing their friendship and their various difficulties in their lives, and kind of how each supported each other and how each one failed each other. At the very end, you know, that one of them felt unknowable to the narrator because she had voted this way. And so that's how it evolved. Yeah.
So did it start as sort of a how-to instruction manual for what to do when you're, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And then from there, you created this relationship between the two women and inserted a piece of conflict. And okay, that's an interesting evolution. So, I mean, the one of the really interesting things about your stories through all of your stories is that it starts out as you think it's about one thing. You think it's about, you know, like the name of the story is just escaping me now, but it's about a school shooting. But it's not about a school shooting, you know, or it's about a synagogue potentially shooting, but that's not at all what it's about. And your ability to, you know, when you hear somebody summarize the story, oh, it's about this. It's not at all about that. And I think that's your gift and the power of these stories is that when you finish it, you're like, that is not where I thought we were going at all. And it's interesting that you also thought that's not where we're going at all. I mean, that's why I like to kind of crawl in your head and see where you started versus where it ended up. And that outside editorial assistance is really very interesting too, that it, you know, that it was your editor who said, this is what it needs and this is where it should go.
Well, I think it is just helpful to have, you know, some readers that you trust that can help you see things another way. Because I think it's, you know, that you get to a certain point and then you're not sure,
right?
You know, where to go. Yeah, yeah. No, it's really helpful.
So, how many drafts was that? Would you say?
It's
hard to say. Probably, yeah. Several.
Yeah, it was several. It was several drafts. It was like maybe, I don't know, six or seven. I mean, I mean, I think the thing that I've learned as a writer is that it's not going to be great the first time, but not to get panicked about it. And that's one thing about, as I've written over the years, that's kind of a relief that actually you write something and it's not amazing the first draft, but then if you stay with it, it can get really good, you know?
Yeah.
So that's one thing I try and tell my students, that there's not a lightning bolt that's going to hit you and it's going to be great the first time. Though, you know, science stories can be really, you know, almost there, you know, sometimes if you're lucky the first time. But often it just takes a lot of excavating and rewriting and reshaping. And then you can science get something that you never even realized you could do.
Yeah.
So I think that ability to stick with it is so key. And it's great that you can control that too.
Right, right. And how did you know at the end that the seventh revision was the final one and that it was ready to go? Like, because I feel like you could play with something forever.
The thing is, I think students always say that, and I'm always saying, you know, whenever I'm reading something anywhere, I'm always like thinking, why did I do that? I wish I could do it again, you know. So actually, I think it's done maybe when other people say it. You know, or when you're just sick of it or you just can't even think where to go with it. Because I think one thing that is true of writers is that you're always dissatisfied, you know, and that it's hard sometimes for me to look back at old work. And sometimes I'll look at it and I'll think, oh, you know, I like that. But sometimes I'll think, oh, I wish I had, you know, written another sentence here or made this flow. You know, there are always ways to play with it, which is kind of a thrilling part, but also, you know, it's part of it. So.
Right, right. It's done when Dan from Counterpoint says it's done, right? That's when it's done.
Yeah, yeah. I think at some point you have a deadline, and then it's like, that's it. You know, but I do think it's so hard to, it's hard to let go as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. So the last time you were on the show, we were talking about your octopus theory, which I had, or octopus thing, what I had never heard of before. And I have been thinking about a lot since and sort of incorporating. And as you're talking about this story, the first Where to Hide in a Synagogue, I'll let you describe the octopus theory and then we can kind of talk about how you utilized it in this story. But maybe refresh our listeners if they hadn't heard it about that. Tell us about
the
octopus.
Now, a theory.
Yeah, it's a theory. It's a whole theory.
It is a theory. So basically, the octopus theory or moment is an idea that I had when I tried to think about plot as a 3D, a 3D construct. That how do stories feel as though they exist beyond the borders of the story? How do they feel larger than what's on the page? Because the best stories make you feel that. You feel like the characters are going to walk off the story into their lives. How do writers do that? And I think what they do is first they create narrative momentum in the present time of the story, where, you know, you're moving forward, you know, the character wants something, the character, you know, you have the main plot, and then you have octopus moments or the body of the octopus is kind of moving forward, and then you have the tentacles that reach forward and in time or backwards in time and, you know, or switch point of view. And they give you enough information, just a little information, to keep the reader going, and can interpret the action in the moment with information that's been given. So in a way, it's sort of a little bit about information distribution.
Yep.
Where you start out, you know, with the one goal, which here, you know, it's like how do they report back to the board with their advice, you know, and then the octopus moments are the little flashbacks that come in to the story, but the idea is how much information do you need to keep the story moving? And you don't want it to be too much, or the tentacle will, like, land in the sand and then, like, bog everything down, you know?
Right.
So I think here that the question is, there are little flashbacks about the friendship throughout, and then you know enough about them, and it informs their present time conversation, so the reader can kind of figure out, you know, who they are.
Right, right. Yeah, and so when you were writing this story, are there pages and pages, like, are there like 25 pages about the women's friendship that you wrote that never made it in here, and then you were like, that's way too much? Or are you really now very good at pinpointing, okay, this is, this tentacle has gone far enough and I can pull it back now?
Yeah, I think I didn't write pages and pages. I think I'm kind of, I think what I've learned about writing is actually, if you find the right details or you find the right information, you don't need very much of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's finding the right action, the right moment that will help inform the characters.
Right.
Yeah. So I think
Do you
think it's actually trusting brevity.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Do you have other brilliant octopus moments in your writerly toolkit that we haven't heard about? Because I really have used that one so much.
I mean, other theories.
Other theories, yeah. Do you have other theories, like a hippopotamus theory of of plot?
I mean, another way I talk about plot with students is the idea of the container. You know, that a story will feel satisfying. Certain stories feel really satisfying because they have strong containers. Which means that they, I think a container is about, setting a story within a certain span of time or a certain very clear action where the whole story is then unified around it. Like, for example, Everything That Rises Must Converge, you know, by Flannery O'Connor has the hat, you know, and the bus ride, you know, with the mother and the son, Julian, and this hat that is about, that really is about, you know, humanity and the sort of bonds between people, you know, within a segregated culture. So that's like a really amazing action and symbol that I think creates a container for the story.
Yeah.
Another great story is Frank O'Connor, Guest of the Nation, which is a story, it's like one of the amazing story where it's about these soldiers in Ireland, and there are these soldiers that capture other soldiers, and then ultimately they become friends, and ultimately they have to shoot them because they've been ordered to do that. Mm. So it's sort of the span of the relationship and friendship within the story is a powerful container. So I talk about that with students, and I feel like in this collection, I think the elevator has a good container.
Yeah.
You know, that you have this episode that happens before She's stuck in the elevator, and then the whole story is set in the elevator. I'm trying to think of another one that could contain that.
I mean, cell phones,
I think, have a good container.
Yeah, cell phones.
You know,
right.
Very good find. Yeah. So, I mean, it's one, not all of them, I think, have such clear containers. Like the New Yorker story doesn't, in my mind, but it still works, you know, in other ways. So it's just another way of thinking about story structure.
Right, right. Or the three interviews that you have, you know, these three containers.
That has a clear container. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the metaphor is really clear.
Right, right. And yes. I think the other nice thing for short story writers is, I mean, it has to be compressed. So it typically is in a mm-hmm. very compressed time period and a very compressed mm-hmm. number of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Although New Order, you know, took place over, time.
Yeah, so. And Alison Rowe is, you know,
right.
like contradicts all those theories.
That's true. Right, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. So I think you can't, I think the idea is somehow the idea of how do you create unity. I think that is really key. Even if it's fragmented, there needs to be some unified metaphor or concept or time.
Right.
Make
right.
it feel satisfying, I
right.
think.
Right.
Yeah.
My guest this morning is Karen Bender. The story collection we're talking about is The New Order. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You also had a great article in the New York Times several years ago about verbs. And verbs are so important to me because I can have a character sit in a room for, you know, probably a lifetime and never get out of it, never get out of bed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this... I think a lot of short story writers get kind of mired in character and forget mm-hmm. that something needs to happen. And so I was going to let you give your verb pitch. Make a case for verbs.
Right. Yes. The emotional power of verbs. I mean, that was something, because I am very similar. I love adjectives. Like, I think people are drawn to certain different types of words somehow intuitively. Like, I loved adjectives. All I would want to do is write, you know, sensory detail and characters, you know, describing them. But I also couldn't get characters out of a room. It was like, how does anyone go anywhere? And I think the idea is I couldn't see verbs as emotional. And I think actually reading Cheever, you know, or, you know, some writers that really use great verbs, you know, really helped me get characters out of the room. But also looking at an architecture of a story is poetic, you know, that I couldn't figure out, like, plot just seemed so burdensome. But I think when I tried to step back and think of plot, you know, as kind of beautiful in itself, and that helped.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I love this. I'm going to make a little pitch for your website, because on your website, which is KarenEBender.com, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You have some really wonderful writing advice. You have, you know, the commandments for writers. You have the revision things for writers. And one of the points about revision that you made, and, you know, you've touched on how important revision is to do this in a, like a peeling an onion, you know, where the first layer of revision is just figuring out what the story is. And then the second layer is figuring out who the characters are. And That's so helpful to me because, you know, when you're looking at this blob of clay in front of you,
right,
trying to figure out how to make it David, you know, that it seems daunting. And so if you're just like, okay, now we're going to work on his finger instead of, you know, the overall task, that's incredibly, incredibly helpful. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your revision kind of process and a little bit more of what it kind of looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably different for each story. Like, I think some stories come out and they don't need as much, and some come out and they're just a complete mess and you have to really rethink them. I think the idea is just realizing that it happens in stages and that it is helpful to maybe address one issue at a time. Like, what I'm trying to do as a writer, it doesn't always work. But is be a little faster and just get out the structure first and try and, you know, and try and find the poetry in the structure and try and just get it out and not get too language obsessed early, which is hard because I love sentences. I love working on language. So one struggle for me is try not to do that too early in a draft because you don't know what will stay and what will go.
Yeah.
So how do you get just everything out, you know, first? So I think that's, that's what I think about first. And then the next thing is character development, you know, like, and science actually starts with a character that you're just so interested in character, you just keep writing about them. So I think, you know, figuring out what a character wants is really important. I think that's often what creates stagnation in a story is not knowing, you know, where they want to go or what they want.
Right.
And, yeah, and then I think layering, like I think I was actually recently telling students, you know, if a character seems really mad in one draft, you know, they may seem not very layered. And then it's like, oh, then you might do a draft where you explore their sadness. You know, what is sad about them? You know, or could you do a, you know, a draft where they're trying to connect with someone? Or, you know, what are ways to layer a narrative that may seem a little bit one note?
Right.
So I think thinking about that is helpful.
This is great.
Yeah.
You just said something that piqued my interest, and now I, you know, my octopus tentacle flashback, and now it's done. Do you work on story?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I think that the thing that's scary about revision is thinking, I just, you know, I have to draw it once, or I have to do something, you know, everything needs to be clear to me the first time, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
It can happen in drafts. And Anne Lamott has this wonderful metaphor about a story being like a Polaroid camera, you know, that it's blurry at first and it becomes clear. So I think that's really one thing I think about.
Right, right. Your point about trying to figure out what a character wants and the story cell phones at the very end, there's this wonderful list saying exactly what this character wants. It's like two pages of I want. And I thought, you know, even if a writer doesn't finish with that, you can't do that in every story, but that's really great scaffolding, I think, if you are trying to train yourself to figure out what a character does want to actually list it out.
I think
lists can be really very helpful to writers, you know, to list what's in somebody's medicine cabinet or their refrigerator or their list of wants and desires or, you know, all of those things I think can at least get you kind of into their head a little bit.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit also about writing in the age of noise. You know, 3 years ago when we talked, we were talking about, the internet's distracting and emails are distracting. And, you know, now it's, well, the world is sort of ending outside the door. So I have to. And yet you've managed to be incredibly productive and move forward. And I was just wondering if you had any advice on sort of how you tune the world out or if you just decide, okay, I'm going to bring the world into my work rather than, you know, trying to keep the world out entirely, or but just kind of how you've managed the last couple of years as a worker.
Yeah. I think there's always noise of all sorts, right? There's noise of the world, which right now is very, you know, is very loud. And should be listened to also, you know, but also needs to be sort of put aside at times. And, you know, there's just the noise of life, you know, where you have to, you know, do work and you know, be in a world and a family. You know, there's just like the world that's there.
Yeah.
But I think it really is just like, when do you find the quiet times to work? And, you know, I try and write whenever I can, and often it can be kind of fragmented. Like sometimes I do have like a several hours I can spend on it. And I think sometimes not. And I think the more you can just like think about how do you dive in if you have an hour, you know, to a story. I mean, I think that is one reason I think stories are helpful to me is because they're, you know, it's, you know, they're smaller scale. So it's easier to go in and out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you work on, only one at a time, or do you have a couple going at once?
It varies. I think sometimes I'll just be working on one, and sometimes if I get frustrated with it, it's helpful to have another. And sometimes I'll be working on one, and I'll just have a new idea, and I'll just scribble down some notes on it. and see if I want to go back to it. Because sometimes I'll have ideas and they'll just not be very viable. And then, you know, I'll abandon them.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that was fun in this collection that I hadn't noticed in some of your other work is a little bit of delve into dystopia and a little bit of delve into magical realism. Not tons, mm-hmm. but a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was new for you. I didn't remember it from before.
Yeah. I mean, in Refund, there were a couple stories that were, you know, playing with that. The cat talk, what the cat said.
Oh, that's right.
As a talk to the cat in it. And then there's one called The Visit, where parents kind of go back in time. But in this one, the story that was really new for me is the Department of Happiness and Reimbursement, which was my first foray into dystopia, and I really enjoyed that. And I'm interested in exploring that more because it just felt very free. And that was something that I just feel like I really learned from my students, you know, just listening to them talk about, you know, what they're reading and their interests and then reading, Margaret Atwood and Ursula Le Guin and looking at how they deal with politics in their work in ways that are incredibly effective and powerful. So I think that was fun.
That's another story that I read that started in your mind from an interview I read of you, very different than mm-hmm. where it ended up. That it's kind of origin mm-hmm. story was very different than its ultimate story. So it started with non-disclosure agreements, right? In your head.
Right. Well, I think that was inspiration, right? Yeah. I mean, I think it basically, I was so upset at the idea of Bill O'Reilly and, you know, that he could pay all this money and all these people that, silence women with money. And it's legal, but it seems like it shouldn't be, you know,
right.
that it seems like a First Amendment violation that, you know, that people are basically paid to be silent. So, I wanted to explore that.
So good.
Yeah.
And I wanted to give a little nod also before we have to sign off to the, there's one kind of almost flash fiction piece in here that's written in second person. Not a different texture in terms of content or subject matter, but, just a different form in terms of brevity and point of view. And I think that can really be a great technique for writers, too, to give a different texture if they're working on a short story collection of trying second person. Not everybody is comfortable in second person. And that story just worked so well for me. I also love flash fiction. So
I love flash fiction. I mean, I think that's the thing about being a writer. You know, talking about origin stories is how you can, you know, just change and explore new things over time. And flash fiction was something I wasn't even aware of a few years ago so much, and now I just love it. And, you know, in Scoundrel Time, where I'm, you know, editing fiction, I publish, you know, a fair amount of flash fiction because I think it really does capture a moment in a way that's so resonant. And, feels especially right for now in certain ways, you know, that it's, you know, there are all these moments that feel so intense and then suddenly it's gone, you know, so, but not gone too. So I think it's a great form. It's really wonderful. It's getting a lot more attention.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't believe we're out of time. We had an hour and I'm also like, we're out of time. Is there advice we should have given people that we somehow missed? More advice that you give out?
Any advice to writers?
To writers?
I think just keep going. I think, you know, writers live in a country, you know, that is not supportive to writing, yet there are all these amazing literary enclaves around the country where writing is valued and people are writing amazing things. But I think just, you know, if you want to write, just keep doing it and say something you feel needs to be said.
I love it. Well, you're certainly doing that. And again, a nod to your website, KarenEBender.com. The great stuff on there. And, you know, a lot of interviews and a lot of articles that you've written and tons of writer advice.
Yeah.
And so, you can also do what I do, which is just stalk you on Facebook. So that's also possible.
That too.
Is Facebook your venue of choice, or do you do Twitter and all those things too?
You know, I do Facebook. I'm feeling very mixed about Facebook right now, you know, but it's it does feel like a good venue for a writing community. So right now I am on there, and I am on Twitter, and I actually just joined Instagram at my son's advice. So I'm on all of them.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I'll keep stalking you, and I'll await the next book, and when it's out, we'll talk again.
Oh, thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was Karen Bender. The book, The New Order, is out and available now. Great Christmas gift. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned. There's more great jazz coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And Barbara will be on next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with Janet Fitch. So tune in then. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.